Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable, quality clothing right here in the USA. Because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise-ready AI.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Vodafone Business. With cybersecurity solutions from Vodafone, your business can hack off the hackers. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll take a closer look at the role social media has played in the US presidential election and what is likely to happen in the online sphere once the result is announced. Plus, as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can do so right now. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. Later in the show, we'll hear about the new jobs announced this week at Microsoft, and we might throw an eye over the new devices announced by Apple as well. But I want to start this week with the US presidential election. As I'm sure you're aware, America will go to the polls on Tuesday in what's being described as the tightest election in recent memory. There's been no shortage of content, commentary, and controversy in the run of this campaign, with much of it playing out on social media. What was once a tool for the political parties to engage with, now, in my opinion, it is a megaphone for bombardment and misinformation. Stephen O'Leary of Alitico is with me now to look back at what's taken place in the social sphere and what is likely to happen next week once the result becomes clear. Stephen, it's always great to chat with you. Before we jump into 2024, I want to look back a little bit. As I said there, social media was a tool, a vital tool for candidates. And it all really started with the first Obama campaign. It was used to engage with audiences and to spread awareness of issues. But things have changed dramatically since those days.
They have. And I think if you were to summarize it, the biggest change has been the polarization of politics in the US. And what's happened with that in conjunction is the algorithms on social networks have gotten better and better at keeping us engaged. And the reality is what tends to keep us engaged are things that annoy us or elicit a strong emotional response. So what you've seen is that in conjunction with this polarized politics, we're increasingly being served content that fits a narrative or fits an existing narrative that we may have or a belief system that we may have as individual users. And what this can lead to is a situation where you're being served content that constantly reinforces what you already believe and doesn't really challenge you in terms of what you think, for example, the outcome of an election might be. And this is true on both sides of this upcoming election. I think we've seen lots of evidence. And in fact, Donny O'Sullivan on CNN did a really good 24 hours in the life of essentially MAGA media piece recently, where he demonstrated what it was like that if you went down a rabbit hole here and started to consume content in this space, that very quickly you got into a reinforcement loop where you were absolutely led to believe that almost regardless of the outcome of the election, that it was going to be stolen for or stolen from Trump. And this narrative was beginning to emerge. So I think from a social media point of view, you always have to be mindful that you're never seeing the full picture. You're not seeing balanced political discourse. You're not seeing the editorial rigor that you get when you consume content from the traditional media, but that often gets forgotten.
Yeah, when I was looking back at the last four or five presidential elections, what really struck me was the shift in tone and messaging. You know, back in the Obama days, it was all very positive with a focus on the bringing together of people, hashtag yes we can, and so on. And when you look at today, there's so much divisiveness and aggression in the language being used. I've been wondering if the political landscape on social media now reflects the tone and approach of the candidates, or is it just the social world and the fragmentation that occurs at the hands of algorithms, echo chambers, and so on?
Oh, well, I think it's probably a bit of A, a bit of B, right? I mean, there's no doubting that the content that elicits the strongest emotional response is usually something that shocks us. So it's like, I can't believe the candidate said that, or I can't believe the representative of the candidate said that. So you look at the recent rallies in Madison Square Garden and some of the acts and individuals who spoke at that event, it was some of their most shocking comments are what grabbed all of the headlines, created all of the social content. And that then is what the majority of audiences will consume when they're on social media. But you're absolutely right. The tone of this campaign has been incredibly negative, very much focused on the other, the opposition candidate. And for better or worse, both camps must believe that this gives them the best chance of success. Otherwise, it would be hard to understand why they were continuing to have that as their strategy. But when that's the candidate or the campaign strategy, you often see that then seep through into social media. If you imagine that every campaign rally or media interview, if their focus is on the candidate, the opposition candidate, and that candidate's failings, their weaknesses, trying to stoke maybe fear if that candidate gets elected, well, then they're the things that get cut into the 10-second and 20-second and 30-second clips that get shared on social media. And as a result, you then get a fear-based social media campaign or a fear-based social media cycle of news. And that tends to reinforce, and suddenly you're kind of stuck in almost a vortex. So I think certainly as analysts, when we look at the type of conversation and the type of content that is being shared in the run-up to this election, without doubt, fear is central to so much of it.
I know I keep looking back, but in 2016, when it was Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, there was an awful lot of talk around the potential of the first female president in Hillary Clinton. A lot of the commentary was feel good, and that definitely gained momentum alongside the negative aspects associated with the Access Hollywood tape and, you know, potentially what a Trump presidency would mean for women. I've been struck by how little I've heard about the potential of Kamala Harris being the first female president. When I'm looking at the broad themes of this election online, what I'm seeing is immigration, abortion, and very divisive issues like that. Do you think the lack of the female president narrative is because Harris was the late replacement for Biden? Or are there just too many other issues that, I suppose, lend themselves well to very loud commentary?
There's no doubt that it is the key focus of the election, like no doubt. And it's what's making the headlines. And it is certainly, in the case of Trump's campaigning, the number one fear that is being stoked and the number one fear that is being highlighted and referenced and constantly being brought back to. But I wouldn't underestimate the female candidate narrative and the potential for the first female US presidential winner. And I think the reason that that is such an important point and potentially such a key point in all of this is when we look back at the last 24 months of American politics, one of the biggest turning points in terms of momentum towards Democrats and away from Republicans was on the back of Roe v. Wade being overturned. And abortion is going to be a key factor when it comes to political voting and the candidates that get chosen on the day. It's obviously very hard to know exactly how big a factor that's going to be, but that wasn't on the ticket back in 2016. It just wasn't up for debate. It wasn't being talked about at any kinds of levels. And we know if we look back at the midterm elections in 2022, that it was central and critical to so much of the voting that took place. So there is a large degree of unknown. And a lot of this, I think what we're seeing certainly discussed socially is a lot of this is going to come out to voter turnout and whether or not both sides can get their actual vote out. But that is a key difference versus 2016. Abortion was not anywhere near as high a topic as it is in 2024. And I would be surprised if when the dust settles on all of this, that the fact that Kamala Harris is a woman and the fact that she has campaigned on this topic is going to be central to the outcome.
I've mentioned it numerous times on this program over the last little while, but Pod Save America is now a staple of my media diet. It's a podcast hosted by former Obama staffers. They're all Democrats, and it's very clear to see where they stand on issues. But one point they've made numerous times over the last wee while is that you can't really trust what you're seeing in the polls or online when it comes to the potential results, because that's a mistake that was made in 2016. I remember I was at Web Summit in 2016, the day of the election and then obviously the day of the results. And I remember being shocked and surprised. And that's because I had been following the polls, following the data, and yet the reality proved to be something very different. You know, is it a case now that we simply can't believe what we're seeing online because the context and the content varies so dramatically depending on which side of the political spectrum you sit?
So we need to be careful with the language we use here. It's not that you can't believe anything you see on social media. I mean, there is a huge amount of truth out there. And there's an awful lot of factual information and there's an awful lot of important information that can be consumed. The key thing is your sources of those information, or sources of that information, I should say, and also what you expect that information to do. So there are things that are absolutely true. Can you predict the outcome of the election based on what's being said on social media? No, you cannot. Have the polls been wrong in the past and under accounted for Trump's vote? They absolutely have. But also a lot has happened since the last presidential election, and polling companies have done their level best and have talked in detail about the steps they've taken to try and allow for some of the things that they perhaps got wrong to recalibrate ahead of 2024. So it's absolutely true to say that social media data and polling data are not going to be perfect predictors of the outcome of the election. But equally, there is valuable information that can be shared socially. And certainly if we look at Kamala Harris and a lot of the social networks that she has lent into heavily in advance of this election, in particular on TikTok, and you look at the endorsements she's had from the likes of Taylor Swift. I mean, you know, in the last couple of months, famously, when Swift endorsed Harris, she shared a link through her Instagram account to allow people to register to vote. Now, we know that there were millions of visits to the voter registration platforms on the back of Swift sharing that post. And based on the demographic of fans Swift has, it's not an unfair assumption to imagine that that skews female and skews younger in terms of gender and age demographics. We don't ultimately know how many of those people who visited the site went on to register and how many of those registered voters will then go to the polls ultimately in November. But if you imagine a percentage of them will, if you imagine that that has had some form of impact, and critically you look at what individual states and the differences in terms of winning and losing were like back in 2020. If you can get 100,000 extra voters to come out for your candidate, that can be the difference between winning and losing a state. And I think, again, it'll be really interesting when we have the results of this election to look back at how many first-time voters emerged. What was the demographic of those voters? And I would be really surprised if there weren't places where a line can be drawn between pivotal moments on social media, like Taylor Swift's Instagram post, and upticks in voters for certain demographics that ultimately influence the outcome of the election.
I suppose the point around believing what you're seeing, I think the context is everything. And, you know, if we look at the Donald Trump event that was held in Madison Square Garden earlier this week, depending on what way you're inclined, either Democrat or Republican, the narratives around that event vary dramatically. Some people were calling it a day of celebration and, you know, an incredible day for free speech and saying it as it really is. And then there was the other end of the spectrum where it caused deep upset and, you know, levels of devastation, I suppose, to not to overstate it, but people were deeply upset by some of the soundbites that emerged from that event. And as a European, as an Irish person looking at the fallout online, I could see the way the information was presented alongside the context in which it was presented, you know, how you could digest it in two different ways. I know that I heard one of Kamala Harris's advisors give a bit of insight a few weeks ago, and they said that when she is speaking publicly, she will speak in sound bites. Like, she will ensure that she is clipped and, you know, concise and takes a breath after a point is made so it can be lifted in full context and people could see the entire thing. From what I saw from the Madison Square Garden event, that wasn't necessarily the case. And so I am curious about the importance of context and seeing the fuller picture, particularly when comments are as upsetting as many people found them from that MSG event.
Yeah, context is critically important. And, you know, social media does not lend itself to two things, context or nuance. You know, neither, unfortunately, are things that that fare well when it comes to social media. And without doubt, if you are in the MAGA camp or a Trump supporter, you will have been fed a certain view of what happened at Madison Square Garden. And the probability is it will have reinforced your existing beliefs about the quality of your candidate, their party, and their credentials to be president. On the flip side, if you're in the Harris camp and you were a decided Harris voter, you would have been served the worst of the worst from that event. And ultimately a spotlight would have been shone on some of, like you say, the horrendous things that were said. What's much more interesting is the space in the middle. So take Puerto Rico, for example, and the Puerto Rican population of the US, or those that would have Puerto Rican heritage. A really interesting moment from the last 48 to 72 hours has been Bad Bunny, a hugely popular musician from Puerto Rico, who essentially, on the back of what was said at Madison Square Garden, wrote like an open love letter to Puerto Rico, reminding everyone of just, you know, how beautiful the country is and how amazing the people are. There are millions of voters in America who are of Puerto Rican heritage, and there will be a very strong crossover with those people and their love of Bad Bunny as an artist. hugely, hugely popular. Just for context, from a social media point of view, 45 million followers on Instagram. So like a significant artist with a very, very big following. Now, had the comments at the rally in Madison Square Garden not been made, we would not be talking about Bad Bunny. He just would not be setting any kind of agenda. But because of it, he has now come out and he's used his social media platforms, Instagram in particular, to endorse Harris, to denounce the commentary that was made, and to call for Puerto Ricans to support Harris in the upcoming election. Now, again, we don't know. If you're of Puerto Rican heritage and you already support Trump, will what have happened at Madison Square Garden change your mind? Possibly not. It may not. If you are a MAGA supporter, we know there's almost nothing that can be said or done by Trump or his crowd that will in any way change your mind. Similarly, if you were already voting for Harris, well, then it'll have just probably made you double down and know that you're absolutely making the right choice. But if you're in the middle, that's where it's interesting. If you're an undecided voter, and maybe you didn't have a very strong feeling towards one candidate or the other, or maybe you were just passive. Maybe you were like, I'm not even sure I'm going to bother voting in this election. This is the type of moment that can absolutely change elections. And the difficulty is quantifying that. We don't know how big an impact this moment will have had. And we don't know how big an impact Bad Bunny's post to his 45 million followers will have had. But the same is true of the Taylor Swift post we talked about earlier. There are lots of these moments in the campaign where something happens, and you're absolutely right. The way that story is told to the two camps suits their own narratives and reinforces existing beliefs. But it's the sliver in the middle. It's the 2, 3, 4% of voters, maybe more, at this point, who haven't made up their mind. Those are the ones that you are hoping to mold and shape and convince, not only to select your candidate, but to be motivated enough then to go out and actually cast a vote. And again, I think that's going to be one of the outcomes of what we saw happen at that most recent rally. I think you're going to see, and again, the demographics will bear this out afterwards, but there will be an increased vote from Puerto Ricans, and they will rally against what was said about their country in Madison Square Garden.
Another thing that I'm really interested in, and I imagine you're much more into the data than I am, but given the way the American electoral system works, like, does any of what we've seen online actually make a difference? From what I've read, seen, heard, and all the rest, it does come down to a few key states. And it comes down to the undecideds and, you know, if they will come out and vote on the day. And I suppose I'm just wondering, like, does any of what we have seen actually matter? When you look at the amount of money that's been spent on TV advertising and social advertising by the candidates and by the parties, like, the social media advertising and engagement, is it useful when it comes down to the simple matter of a few states that could be swayed more convincingly by a knock on the door and a leaflet left in the hand?
That's a great question. And you're right. Billions are being spent on this campaign. I mean, it's kind of staggering, the amount of money that's being spent. And obviously that's not exclusively on social. And it's this weird loop where the money is being raised to raise more money. So if you look at what a lot of the advertising looks like on social media, it's actually less about saying, get out and vote for our candidate. It's support for our candidate by donating to our campaign. And yet that money is then being used to serve you up more of these ads. So it's just this constant loop of raising money and then spending money to raise more money, and on and on and on. So like, the impact of the advertising and how effective it is very difficult to measure with any degree of certainty. But again, there's a huge amount of research that goes into this and has done, not just in the last kind of two or three cycles, but for 30 or 40 years, the impact of targeted advertising at a state level, be that on local TV stations or in print. Again, a lot of it probably reinforces existing beliefs. So you're being served a story that you already know if you're a Trump or Harris supporter. I think the sad thing is that they're all battling for not really America and not even on a state-by-state level. They're literally battling for those percentages, the 2-4% maybe, that are open to being swayed or convinced or encouraged to vote one way or the other. And it's an incredible amount of money to be spending for such a small audience. The one thing that we know is that what social media can be very good at is targeted advertising. Mm. And it is one of the reasons why the networks prove popular with political candidates and campaigns, because they do have the ability at both a state and a more local level to really target their messaging and factor in other things like age and gender and a whole host of demographic factors that allow us to kind of see where the message is being served. The other thing to probably note here is that there's a, 2024 probably has a greater degree of transparency around where a lot of the spend is going than almost any election that's come before it. Because certainly it's one thing that the social networks have had to do. They have had to open up about how candidates are spending their money, what type of messaging they're serving, where that messaging is being targeted. So we actually have a much better ability now to see where the money's going. And how, as I say, the individual candidates and campaigns are trying to sway those critical swing voters.
Okay, stay with me if you don't mind, Stephen O'Leary of Alitico, because we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to look ahead to the potential fallout that may arise depending on whether it is a red win or a blue win. Don't go anywhere.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Stephen O'Leary of Alitico is still with me, and we are looking at the role social media has played in the presidential election campaign so far. But Stephen, if we can take out the crystal ball and look ahead to next week, regardless of the results, what do you anticipate happening in terms of online narratives? Because as you alluded to before the break, from the MAGA side, there's already talk of, if we don't win, it's because the election was stolen. And we know that the narrative is an attractive one to the followers that Donald Trump has. We know that social media and online media communication tools as a whole played a key role in the January 6th insurrection. I suppose how early into election night are we anticipating the flames to start flickering and narratives to be spun regardless of who is victorious?
Well, I think we, in a way, we can't really make a statement of regardless who wins, because we know from history that if Trump wins, well, then Trump will win and that will be it, to an extent, right? It's not to say that there won't be court cases and other bits and pieces that will be brought forward. But ultimately, if Trump wins the Electoral College vote, then he will become president, and that's what will happen. The greater fear in one way is if Harris wins, because particularly if in some states the margin is small or low, what we know is that probably at no point in US history has there been a greater level of focus and scrutiny on the voting process, on the individual people who work at polling stations, and everyone associated with that kind of whole area is essentially primed for what's going to come. And if Harris is declared the winner, we saw in 2020 what the level of vitriol looked like. We heard the phone calls and we read the transcripts of the pressure that was coming from the then sitting president to try and find extra votes or to try and change the actual results. And obviously it all culminated in what we saw on January 6th and those terrible scenes. I do think there is the benefit of now being warned about what might happen. And I would be very surprised if at a state level there wasn't incredible levels of security around polling stations, and around any areas where there is an expectation that kind of political announcements or voting result announcements will be made. Because I would expect, certainly given what's being served up to the Trump supporters through that kind of MAGA media piece, they're being absolutely primed for the fact that their vote is going to get stolen. And it is worrying. It's really worrying to think about sort of what that could potentially lead to. But we do, as I say, have the benefit of going into this eyes open. 2020 taught everybody, law enforcement, politicians, like those, as I say, involved in voting and elections, a huge amount about what to potentially expect. So I think the level of surprise is what's being taken away. So I expect it, I anticipate it, and I do think it comes down to who wins. Because if it's a Trump win by electoral college vote, well then I think that will kind of be the end of it. If Harris wins, I would fear for what will happen in the days, weeks, and months that follow.
Yeah, I think we are buckled in for a long ride regardless. And I don't think it is going to be wrapped up with a neat little bow as quickly as some people might anticipate. But I guess it reinforces the need to get your information from verified sources, from trusted sources, and to be eyes wide open when it comes to the content that is being presented to you. Because obviously, and this will be a shocker to nobody, but we're not American, so it doesn't overly impact us. But it is a good practice to get into as well, because the function and the agenda of the US president will impact us. And I think the first 100 days of the next presidency will be important to us and the wider world, given the ambitions and visions of both candidates, right?
Absolutely. And the point is extremely well made. We're talking about this in the context of the US presidential election because that's what's up next. But the lessons we can learn and the approach we can take in terms of just being media literate, social media literate, and essentially seeking out reputable news sources. And something I come back to regularly is you don't have to be tuned into the radio, you don't have to watch TV. You don't have to pick up a newspaper, but the journalists who are broadcasting on the radio, the presenters who are on television, and those who write in our newspapers all have social media accounts, and they all work for news organizations that have verified social media accounts. You can go to those accounts for information. And again, in Ireland, I think we're very lucky that there is a very strong and robust media sector and some excellent journalism, which can be sought out, but you need to seek it out. You need to go and find it and not rely on just what you're served up by the algorithm of the network you're connected to.
All right. I have no doubt that we will be hearing from you again over the coming days, and I guess we will just see what happens. Stephen O'Leary of Politico, thank you as always for joining me here on News Talk.
Thanks, Jess.
Yeah, I'd love to know your thoughts. Do you think that too much is placed on social media when it comes to elections? We're obviously expecting the Irish general election to be called this coming week. And I have no doubt that social media will play a key role. Let me know what you think. Techtalk@newstalk.com. And while you're there, give me your thoughts on this.
Hey, it's Taylor Swift. You all know who I want to vote for in the American election. But if I was voting in Ireland, it would be only one man. That's Michael Healy Wray. You know what? The Tay-Tay loves the Healy Wray. That's right. Best of luck, Michael.
Yeah, that is an AI version of Taylor Swift endorsing Michael Healy Wray. This video surfaced online. It's one of a few AI videos that have been used by Michael Healy Wray over the last little while. There's no denying that they're funny. There was one of himself and Simon Harris, AI versions of himself and Simon Harris going to battle, and it made me laugh. But I have to say, I don't like it. I don't like the normalization of AI being used in this way, particularly in the political sphere. I think it's tough enough to believe what you're seeing as it is. And even when you take into consideration the crack factor, it's just not a good thing. That would be my take. But let me know what you think. TechTalk@newstalk.com. Right. When we come back here on News Talk, we'll take a closer look at the 500 new jobs announced by Microsoft, and I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. If you want to get in touch, as always, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. Earlier this week, Microsoft announced it was creating 550 additional jobs in Ireland. This is in relation to its AI operations. Ireland was chosen as a key location for the global AI drive, aiding in the development of new technologies for its global operations and spanning some of the company's key focus areas for the future. My colleague Joe Lynham spoke to James O'Connor, Microsoft Ireland site lead, about data centres, working from home, and these AI jobs.
It's a strategic investment in our Irish operations. It really strengthens our ability to do advanced AI globally here. And it's all focused, obviously, on delivering safe, secure, and ethical solutions to our customers across all industries. Obviously, Joe, we've been partnering with IDEA. We'll be 40 years in Ireland next year. Microsoft has continued to innovate, transform over those 40 years. IDEA has been a critical partner through that. This means that we're building on our existing Microsoft Ireland's engineering hub that's already here. We've got core engineers working on many of our core products across all our different solution areas for commercial and consumer customers. And this really adds an end-to-end AI product development capability to all of those engineering teams.
And will you guys be trying to source accommodation for all these new staffers?
No, because we expect to hire the majority of them in Ireland. We've got great talent base here. We've added a number of engineering teams and roles over the last few years, and we've hired the majority of those folks in Ireland. Yeah, continually, obviously, we'll always continue to hire internationally. We got 96 nationalities on our workforce here, but we are basically sourcing the majority of our engineering talent in Ireland.
I presume most of these jobs will be in Leopardstown in South County Dublin.
Yes. So we have two major buildings here in the Leopardstown right beside the racecourse, and one of them is dedicated to our software engineering community, and that's where these roles will be based from. Of course, they'll have hybrid opportunity as well. We provide that as a flexibility to all employees, and they can work up to 50% of their time remotely. And we're finding that we have incredible energy and connection across all the different functions we have here in Ireland. People like coming into the office and getting that energy, connecting and learning from each other and innovating.
Okay, so you won't be going down the Amazon route of demanding everyone back in the office from January.
No.
Okay. AI requires a lot of computing power, which requires a lot more data centers, which of course is a hot political potato as we face into an election in about a month. Where will you keep or store all these additional terabytes of data?
Yeah, like Microsoft is investing significantly in data center infrastructure around the world. We're seeing unprecedented demand in AI and AI capabilities. We have products across all our different services and offerings. Our core product is called Copilot. So obviously that has more computing demand, and obviously computing demand means data center demand. And data center demand also means energy demand. But we're investing right around the world. We've continued to invest in our data center infrastructure here in Ireland. We certainly have some projects that we plan to do here and that are in consultation. But we're also very focused on sustainable energy and making sure that we're powering these data centers with 100% renewable energy. We still have a commitment as a company to become carbon neutral by 2030. And that's a commitment we're holding very focused on. We stay very focused on that target, despite the buildup that we have at data centers around the world.
Do you employ more people in Microsoft today than ever before, even after the so-called tech wreck of 2022?
Yeah, like we made some difficult decisions like many other companies, and we continue to always look at our resources and our talent and our capacity And are they aligned to our strategic priorities? And are they aligned to where our customer needs and demands are? So that has led to some difficult decisions along the way. But at the same time, our workforce now is even greater and higher than what it was after we went through all of those changes. With this investment, together with our campus here in Leopardstown, alongside our data center campus, which is in Grahamstown, and then our LinkedIn operations, which is part of Microsoft, we'll be over 6,000 people. So very significant presence and commitment. And this is a very key and critical international hub for Microsoft.
Yeah, that was James O'Connor of Microsoft Ireland speaking to Joe Lynham on Friday's Breakfast Business. It's great to see jobs like this in Ireland. I was out at the Microsoft campus a few weeks ago, and it is just such a brilliant tech hub for us to have in our capital city. And so that is great news indeed from Microsoft. Let's take a look at some of your questions. I can't get over the amount of people already on about Christmas recommendations. I don't know, you may not want to hear this, but I will start the Christmas gift guiding bits and pieces in the coming weeks. So do stay tuned for that. But let's kick off with an email here from Anne, who says, "Hi, Jess, I hope you're well. Thank you so much for the tech advice before in relation to the Kindle. I have another question. We are a Google Home and are looking to get a smart speaker. Just wondering if you would recommend the Nest Mini or the Nest Hub. Thanks so much." Okay, this is something that is right up my street. We are also a Google Home and we have quite a few of the different bits and pieces throughout the house. I've mentioned before that we have the Google doorbell and we have two of the Nest Minis. So these are the very small smart speakers. They kind of look like the size of a hockey puck and you plug them in. They can be connected. You add them to the Google Home app on your device and you can play music, you can play podcasts, you can use it as a smart speaker, you can listen to the radio. It's fantastic. And the sound quality of them is great for such a small device. The difference between those ones and the Hub, the Nest Hub, is that the Nest Hub has a screen on it. Which is great. You can have your photographs come up, you can have a calendar come up, you can set reminders on it. It's very, very useful. I know that a few people have the Nest Hubs in their kitchen and they might watch, you know, cooking tutorials, that kind of thing on them. So they are great. It depends on what you want to use it for. I know people get frustrated when I say that, but it really does. So we are using the Nest Minis. We have them associated with our doorbell. So when someone rings our doorbell, because we don't have a traditional doorbell chime, the chime sound comes out of the Nest Minis. We have one upstairs and we have one downstairs, and it announces that somebody is at the door. Now, I am contemplating buying a Nest Hub as well to have in the kitchen because I do think it would be useful. I like the idea of having one with the screen. So if you just wanted to play music or the radio, or, you know, as a smart assistant, the Nest Mini is great and it is really good value. And as I said, the sound quality is great. If you do want that video aspect or to have, you know, a shared family calendar in the kitchen or anywhere in the house, really, then the Nest Hub. So you can't go wrong with either, but just try and decipher what it is that you want to do and go from there. Another question in from Brian. He says, "Hi, Jess, I'm due an upgrade. Will I go for the Pixel 9 or the Pixel 9 Pro?" So just like the Google question, you cannot go wrong with the Google Pixel device, in my opinion. The Pixel 9 Pro is the phone that I use. I am a huge fan of it. I moved away from an iPhone 15 Pro to this, and I don't miss the iPhone at all. The camera is incredible. I like the slightly larger screen. I would think that the biggest version available would be too big for me, the XL, so I like the Pro. If you want the best camera possible, with a better battery life and a gorgeous screen, as well as a ton of processing power built in, as well as Gemini, I would go for the 9 Pro. It's honestly my favorite phone of the year. I love it and would highly recommend it. People have actually said to me, we were at the Radio Awards last month and I took quite a few photographs, as I, you know, tend to do. And the amount of people who were texting me on the night going, what phone do you have? Because the images looked incredible. And that was in dark light, like it was at a in a function room kind of thing. And the camera just did so incredibly well. The clarity of the images is just remarkable. So, yeah, if it was me, I would go with the 9 Pro. Would highly recommend to a friend and to you. Right, that is it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.